episode. What are you going to talk about today?
So, as we noticed, the weather has improved. Mm-hmm. Sunny there, warming nicely. At night we have 10 above 12 degrees. Which nature is blooming. And so we gardeners are so eager to go out there and start planting and bring the garden to life. And all that, besides cleaning the garden, removing weeds, also brings what we call soil preparation and soil amendment. So that's what we are going to talk today about, what to consider when we are going to prepare the land, the soil, for the new crops.
Great. And then how do we do that?
So how we do that? So the reason that we tend... So we have two trains or two philosophies. One, it says we need to loosen the soil because it's compact over the winter. Mm-hmm. By loosening it, we bring air into the soil. The soil gets less compact. As well, that motivates that the bacteria activity grows. The population starts growing. Organic matter decompose. More nutrients are released for the plants.
Right.
There is other thought that we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't till. We shouldn't disturb how the soil is, because the soil has its own life. You mean bacteria, fungi, invertebrates.
Yeah.
They have their ecosystem. So there is this true approaches. But what we do here in Bark is we loosen the soil.
Yeah.
For that, we use a tool which is called a spading fork.
Yeah.
And we use that with dip the fork into the soil, and with back and forth movements, we loosen the soil. We advise not to turn the soil, so not to bring the bottom of the soil to the top, because all the living things might be killed because of the sunlight. So there is bacteria that don't like sunlight. So
that's a bit in line with the idea of not really disturbing the soil too much. You want to aerate the soil, but you don't want to really disturb it a lot.
That's right. Yes. So we just want to make it more loose, a bit of crumbly, so when you put your seedlings and your seeds, they have a nice bed where to start growing.
Right.
Yeah. Excellent. So that's the idea behind tilling the soil. And, of course, we have to do things at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
So tilling the soil usually at the beginning of spring, at the beginning of summer when we are putting our summer crops, and at the beginning of fall when we are moving our fall crops. So there is kind of three times a year that we really do a big work in the soil.
Yeah.
And what we later, during these times, we maintain the soil, particularly when you water, and let it get hot like now, the top of the soil tends to get crusted, baked, because it's, and then we need to loosen that, so anytime you water in, the water really seeps into the soil.
Right.
So then we use small tools like the hand trowel just to break that crust and make the soil friable again, so the water can seep.
Right.
So that's one. The other thing that we consider is tilling at the right, not tilling when the after a rainfall period.
Right.
So we have to wait at least 48 hours after a rainfall in order to work the soil.
And why would you want to avoid working the soil at that time?
Because the soil, if it's depending the texture, if it's too clay, the soil will attach to the tool. Rather than loosening, we are compacting the soil. So we don't want to disturb too much. Again, it's try to reduce the amount of disturbance. But yeah, so after a rainfall, we don't touch the soil. We just let it there to drain, to dry out, and later, if it's needed, we will do it. But no, after a rainfall.
Well, that sounds a bit like a win-win then, because, of course, if you're trying to get out in the garden, when everything's wet and soggy, you're going to be making a mess anyway.
Correct. So you don't want to compact, because the soil is... It will be damaged, the texture. Yeah.
Yeah.
The structure, I'm sorry. Yeah, so that's one. The other is... Do not underestimate the job. Sometimes we say, oh, yeah, I can do that in an hour. And you didn't realize that the soil is heavy, that the tool is perhaps not the right tool that you are using. And the next day you are feeling in your body. So take it easy. there's no reason to go and try to do everything at once, do it slowly, carefully. That is comes when we have a piece of land that you start to work, and there's lots of weeds.
Right.
So what I do is first remove the weeds first, remove the weeds from the roots. So what I do, I use my sickle, which cuts underneath the roots, and I pull that, shake it, leave this shake, and just remove the plants.
Yeah.
The soil stays in the garden.
Yeah.
And then when there is no weeds, I go and work the soil.
Yeah.
I have seen people go and without weeding first, they work and right. work the soil, and then you have all these clumps, soil, weeds, all mixed together,
right.
And then you see like the task is has no end because you try to get rid of the weeds at the same time that you want to loosen the soil. So one task at a time, so slowly, as I say, use the right tool. Depending what you're going to do, loosen the soil, we use the spading fork very much.
Yeah.
I try to avoid using shovels or spading or the spade, but just the fork.
Yeah.
Simple.
I guess it depends on your situation. You know, if you have, you know, garden rows in your yard, you might use a large fork for standing up with. But in your boxes, you might use more of a hand tool.
Yes, we use this as a spading fork.
Yeah.
Because it allows us to go deep enough, and the soil that we use is very loose as well, so it's not much problem. So depending the type of soil you have and whether you're gardening in boxes or in a community garden, you will use the right tool. Yeah. As we work in our garden, a box 4 feet by 4 feet, we are as well methodical. We start loosening the soil from the center outwards, so we dip the fork in the middle of the box and then back and forth, and we walk outwards. Yep. And then we walk all around the box, so I'm loosening everything. So if you're in a garden bed that is longer, you will do half from one end, from the center outwards, and from the other half, you will do the same.
Right.
So let's try to don't get all mixed because, it's can get very, very exhausting. Just like, it's a work that is not ending.
Yeah.
And so once the soil is nice and crumbly, we try to improve the fertility, the soil fertility, and that's why is we use amenders.
Yeah.
There are two types of fertility.
Yeah.
Physical fertility and the chemical fertility of the soil.
Yeah.
So physical fertility means that it's crumbly, it's loosened. So if you have a soil that is heavy in clay, you will add more organic matter, try to add a bit of clay, of sand, try to add more compost in order to make it more loose,
right.
So improve the structure of the soil. Now, if you want to make it more fertile, so you have already a crumbly soil that you want to make more fertile, you will bring more organic matter, more compost, perhaps a soil that is engineered and rich in organic matter.
Yep.
So try to balance these two. So you have to decide what I'm going to do. So, for instance, if you want to improve the structure, make it more loose, you will use coconut corn or peat moss, which we try to avoid using that, but that will make it more friable, lighter.
And of course, one of the things we did a long time ago last year was take some of our organic debris from the garden and dig it into the
dig it into the soil to make so that organic matter will as well take a bit of the nitrogen in order to decompose, so it will compete with the plants from nitrogen, but if it is enough organic matter that will replace that, or you have planted some peas or beans which will put nitrogen in the soil, will be also so that's depends why you how you will amend your soil. Here in Bark, we get a soil amender from one of the companies, commercial companies that sell in bags in a big cubic yard of soil, and that we bring to the garden. So because our composter is not enough for the full garden, so,
right.
So we need to bring somewhere else. Yeah, that's how we improve the chemical fertility of the soil. The physical fertility, the soil is very loose. Now and then, we had to try to not to add too much the basic soil for planters, which is rich in sand, so we don't want to do that. So we just focus on amending the soil. Usually we have a schedule of each 2 years we add a soil amender to our garden.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the work that involves.
Yeah.
So in here we have our garden bed, our garden in the third floor.
Yeah.
And the only way to get to the garden is through the elevators. So any materials that we bring have to go through the elevator.
Right.
And bringing compost, which is not the smelly one. So, yeah, it's quite a challenge not to leave us a trail.
And I guess you also just don't want to do more work than you need to by doing more of that than is necessary either.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So every couple of years is generally good.
Yes. Yeah. So that's how we find each 2 years we bring a soil amender. Each year we add the compost that comes from the composter.
Yeah.
And then we have, we add as well a bit of lime and Epsom salts to our garden. Yeah. So, yeah, bit by bit, we try to keep the soil fertility. So, yeah, so if you have your garden out there, it's time to start thinking, how am I going to work the soil,
yep.
loosen it up, and which kind of soil amender I'm going to add, either to increase the fertility, chemical fertility, or the physical fertility.
And taking these steps is going to really help your success.
Yes, it will success, because if you work trying to improve the structure, make it the soil a bit fluffy, the water will seep better, the roots will grow better into the soil, and that will later display as well into a good production.
Excellent. So don't miss out on your soil preparation at the start of your season, each season, because you're mentioning sort of repeating some of these tasks.
Yes. So the soil amender, basically what we do is early spring.
Yeah.
So at this time of the year, because it will last during the summer and fall.
We try
to avoid adding any soil amender during the fall because of the rain.
Yeah.
Too much rain, all the nutrients that we have added to our soil will be washed away.
Yeah.
so we just do once at the beginning of the season in spring.
Yep. Great.
All right.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank
Pablo
you.
Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. Tell us how people can find out more about Embark.
Embark can be found through our social media channels at Embark Sustainability, or visit our website, embarksustainability.org.
Great. Thanks for joining me today. We'll be back again next week.
Next week, yep.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
All right, Peter R.H. here in the studio with me today, as he is every week. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk about Milton Friedman, because what sort of interests me, he was a pretty well conservative economist, a monetarist. He was a disciple of like Hayek.
Mm-hmm.
And John Kenneth Galbraith was a disciple of Keynes.
Mm-hmm.
And Milton Friedman became the disciple of Hayek. And monetarism is the name for it.
And those two, Hayek and Keynes,
yeah,
were sort of the leading sort of economists of the first half or so of the 20th century.
Well, it kind of eclipsed over to monetarism, because Nixon actually at one point said we're all Keynesians now during his presidency,
yeah,
when the Keynesian model had sort of broken down, arguably.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I just learned now about Milton Friedman, he was actually against the existence of the Federal Reserve, which I just, that's a bit kind of out there, because he actually believed the Federal Reserve ultimately should be replaced with a computer program. I guess he, so that's sort of new. I just found that out right now in looking at the Wikipedia. What's sort of interesting is that in contrast to now, with the Donald Trump tariffs, he's looking a bit better. But he sort of paved the way kind of for what we got in a way, I would argue.
Let's, just before we jump right into it, not everyone's going to know a lot about Milton Friedman, so let's give a very quick summary there.
He was born 1912, and he died to 2006 at age 94. So he was sort of Reaganomics is sort of a slang term because it's monetarism, but and so he sort of was seen as being the person pushing Reaganomics.
Right.
Now, what's sort of interesting is that he was always against tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
He was. He said tariffs are a bad idea. And it's interesting that Reaganomics is, I mean, I think Milton Friedman had met Reagan a lot of times, and he was sort of helping with the campaign. In fact, the other thing about Milton Friedman, he said, I'm not choosing to go with the Libertarian Party. I'm going to say I am a member of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So he sort of, but some libertarians like Milton Friedman, though. Mm-hmm. But
well, probably, I guess, you know, he had his ideas, which were sort of different, you know, in terms of, you know, monetarism and stuff, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but it is putting emphasis on managing the money supply as a way to influence the economy where needed, but also his general view was that government should stay out of the economy as much as possible.
Yeah. He's against socialized medicine, which I don't agree with. I saw a YouTube posting of him saying, well, costs go up. Actually, it seems to be the opposite. Once you, the United States, I think they do per capita more in Canada. The thing about what that issue is that I'm not going to be a propagandist for our what we have. I think it's better, but I think there are situations where some people in Canada, depending what their situation or economic status is, they would be better off being in the United States. That I mean, unfortunately, that happens at times, but overall, I think our system is the better one.
Yeah.
And I think Milton Friedman's argument is sort of not valid. He tends to say the costs go up with socialized medicine. Now, I think that's sort of true of other things. Like, I think in the Soviet Union, everything was the government, right? And there were problems with that. But I think he's not right about that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if this is what Friedman exactly believed, but certainly a lot of his followers and people who look to him for guidance is, you know, in this, they believe in sort of the supremacy of the free market, and that the free market,
yes,
you know, is the best vehicle for determining things in all situations. Personally, I don't agree with that. You know, I think there are lots of situations where the free market doesn't work that well. And particularly where the purchaser and the buyer are not necessarily the receiver of the service. You know, schools might be a good example of that. Students are not the ones necessarily buying the service, right? So you can, you know, the market economics that are, you know, trying to operate in cost and prices and stuff like that don't necessarily work to the benefit of students, for example. And I would say the same thing is often the case in healthcare, where, again, you know, it's not like someone in, you know, who needs a heart operation is even qualified to shop around you know, to get the best price, right?
Right, yeah.
You don't have the information or the expertise to assess this doctor versus that doctor versus this technique. Or, you know, you just kind of have to trust their professionals who have your best interest in heart, at heart, and go with it for the most part, you know. And I think, you know, the idea that market economics work in those areas, and there are other examples, you know, just doesn't seem to hold water. And you know, empirical observation of how it works in the real world would, in my opinion, seem to support that.
Well, one of the criticisms that Milton Friedman got was he was advising the Chilean government in the mid-1970s, which Pinochet was the name, had a coup, a fascist coup, and he sort of said, well, it's not that I really agree with everything, but I'm just giving them advice on how to have free market. I mean, it kind of seemed a bit in bad taste, you know. But one of the other things was that what kind of got me interested was how I saw by accident a YouTube posting about immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he was sort of saying, well, most of us would say in the late 19th century, this must have been the 1970s he was doing it, saying this, we would be for what the Statue of Liberty is saying, that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the immigration came. And he said, well, ironically, a lot of these people would not be agreeing with this now. And he said, well, the problem is that an immigrant gets access to the welfare system. That's one thing that he said. But one thing that he thought was kind of a strange thing to say, he said he was for illegal immigration because they would not be on the social programming. So, and it's interesting that now you got this hysteria towards illegal immigration.
Yeah.
It's to blame for everything, but he just sort of goes, well, it's kind of white noise. I mean, it's like they're actually doing jobs we don't want to do, and they come across and they don't join up for our programs. So right. They actually give, and which is a bit of bad taste. You know, he's sort of
it's a bit of an exploitative view of the situation, right?
I mean,
because it's like, well, we can get the benefits of their labor without having to give them the benefits of being a member of our society.
Well, what's sort of interesting, I think, now is that, in a way, Milton Friedman was sort of the basis of, like, Reagan and so on and how things have transpired. But it's interesting, the ante is up with Donald Trump. He's sort of gone, he made aspects of Milton Friedman look kind of okay. Not entirely, but you know what I mean. It's sort of, so we kind of developed really to something kind of worse, and a lot of things that Milton Friedman wouldn't be agreeing with. I actually heard a podcast that was done like a month ago, so it's kind of contemporary about the situation, and about these followers of Milton Friedman, and they were saying that subsidies are better than tariffs. They were saying, like, we would do better having subsidies. They don't know how many in the United States.
Right. So what, subsidizing industries they want to promote?
Yes, and then having a tariff against them. That's what they said. So that was sort of interesting. Mm-hmm. One thing that sort of brought forth a bit of a slight, not kind of on the same wavelength, but one thing is, there's been criticism of our dairy boards, our dairy tariffs, and so on.
Right, our managed supply
now,
for dairy products. Yep.
Under Wikipedia, they call it Dairy and Poultry Supply Management in Canada, which it seems. But one thing, a few thoughts about it. Maybe, Magnus, you can add a bit to this. Don't you want your milk and your poultry and your eggs to be local, as it were? I mean, you don't want it brought in from Texas. What are your feelings about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of foodstuffs, you know, you want to be where you can, particularly fresh foodstuffs, you know, produced locally within reason, right?
Right.
It certainly contributes to food security, you know. You know, and, you know, I mean, a lot of the stuff we do get in the supermarket is coming from California and coming from Mexico. And
avocados.
Yeah. So, but, you know, dairy in particular is very short-lived. You know, if it's spending days in transit, that's that much, you know.
That, yeah.
If it's only good in your fridge for a couple of weeks, you know, if you're losing days in transit, you know, to save a few pennies, maybe that's not a real victory.
So I actually think that really it's an invalid attack against us, because I think what's interesting that the podcast I heard, they were saying they like subsidies as opposed to tariffs. Well, in many ways, our tariffs are to avoid subsidies, one could argue.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with it. I've heard for years, like, we pay too much for cheese in Canada or whatever. I think it's also, about the way the farm animals are treated, is that part of it, Magnus, a little bit, that we have other...
I'm not so sure, but I think, you know, that that's necessarily a part of our particular, you know, the management scheme for those products. But it probably should be more broadly. You know, I think lots of people would say that, you know, we're getting far away from Milton Friedman here. But, you know, there's a lot of things done in the sort of the big business, you know, farm industry that are hard to defend for anything else other than producing low prices. But do we really, you know, is animal suffering necessary just to give us low prices, or should we really perhaps pay a little more so that, you know, that food production system is more ethical?
Well, the reason I sort of brought it up is because on that podcast they were saying subsidies were better than tariffs, but I think it's just the management of it.
Yeah.
And we've been under attack. They'll attack us for anything,
okay,
which is totally invalid.
Right. All right. Well, let's finish up here. What's your last word on Milton Friedman?
Well, he was for a negative income tax. Have you heard that previously?
I have not heard that, but would that be like basically almost like a guaranteed income? You know?
Well, there's a bit of a... supposedly, the thing about that is that it's a bit different in... sort of, I don't know, there's a particular reason, like he would probably be against an annual guaranteed income, but he's for a negative income tax. It's sort of the same thing. But one thing to end on this, supposedly, I'm going to talk about what I heard about New York. They were saying that for every person on welfare during the 70s, two people were actually employed for that person.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why there was so much money being spent, because you got, and they're getting more than being on welfare, the two people employed for those one person.
Right.
And New York, as you probably heard, got into economic trouble during the 1970s. So I guess that would be sort of, he also said that then you wouldn't, he said that people on welfare get taxed 100% if they get some employment. And so he's been sort of an advocate of that. Yeah. Which is sort of not brought up with a lot of the lovers of Reagan about that, those concepts. Anyway, so it's gotten worse than him.
Well, that's because we have Trump.
Yes, anyway.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the show. This has, of course, been Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll be back tomorrow morning with a brand new episode and more local features and election reporting hosted by Jesse Wensloff. This edition, the Monday edition, will, of course, be back next week. It will be election eve, and we'll on the cusp of all that's new to come, depending on the results of that election, but with our regular features and so much more. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right next, and a whole lot more great programming coming up here on CJSF 90.1 FM throughout the day.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
Eravamo ancora fanciulli e ogni sera su